in session number 10923, Reel 5.
Mr. Harold Harper, Reel 5. How long were you with the 4th RHA, approximately?
I was thinking 3 to 4 weeks before returning to the battery at Mersey-Mitrieu.
And you rejoined the headquarters of...
I rejoined headquarters of 426 battery, that's right.
Life carried... You stayed at Mersey-Mitrieu for quite a while more. Just wanted to ask about a couple of features of life there that perhaps we haven't covered before. Do you have any recollections of the concert party?
None whatsoever. That was held, I think, at regimental headquarters, which was quite some distance away, actually.
So that didn't impinge on your life at all?
So it didn't impinge on my life at all, no.
What about any particular characters or any particular incidents that happened? Was there anyone that comes to mind from that period?
Not particularly, it was quite a sort of dull period, really, apart from the occasional bombing. It was...
Were you attached to either the composite battery that was formed or to the dummy battery?
No. Having already had experience with the 4th RHA, I didn't go with the composite battery or the dummy battery. That was mainly drawn from 425 battery.
Were there any particular Christmas celebrations there?
Very few, quite frankly. Nothing really special.
Was there any special provision of meals or drink?
I think we had an extra drink from what I... You know, it was such a long time ago, but I think I can recall extra drink at Christmas.
Now, in January, the regiment moved off to the Nile, the Delta.
That's right.
But you didn't.
I didn't go with them. No, I was delegated to remain with the rear party.
What was the job of the rear party? Well,
that was to tidy up everything that had been left, to make sure the position was habitable for anyone else who was coming in. As you might imagine, having resided there for some 6 months... there was quite a lot to do.
How many would there be left?
There'd be about 20 in the rear party. Mm. And we worked for very, very hard for about 3 or 4 weeks, going around reeling wire in and, sort of making all the gun positions sort of habitable again.
Were the replacement batteries not in?
No, at that stage, no.
So it was just empty?
Just empty, mm-hmm.
When did you rejoin?
Well, we didn't go down to the canal zone, but we went straight to a new camp called Tahag, spelled T-A-H-A-G, which... the regiment joined us there. So we were the first people into this new camp.
What was it like when it was set up, was it?
Oh, it was very comfortable. It's all tents, of course. Tents which housed about 12 men to a tent, something like that. And of course having NAFI facilities and a camp cinema, it was all very, very good indeed.
What sort of cinema, they're quite interested in what sort of films were shown or were you particularly interested in?
Oh, mostly American comic films, Laurel and Hardy, that sort of thing.
Were there any training films or propaganda films?
No. No, there one little bit of propaganda which I remember whilst we were there. We were practice dive bombed for the very first time. I don't know whose idea it was, but it was very, very weak. All that happened really was the same thing that happens today. I mean, planes were just sort of coming down to a fairly low level and then just swooping up again. The sort of thing you see at an air display nowadays. But it didn't impress us an awful lot.
What were you supposed to do?
I think it was to get used to the idea of something zooming at us, quite frankly. But we trained very hard there. We by then we were fairly seasoned desert warriors, having sort of had some sort of experience, and
What about your speed of getting into action, getting, you know, firing, that you mentioned had been slow before then? Had these picked up?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, most definitely. The fact that we'd been all together for a number of months, we'd improved beyond recognition, quite frankly. Yeah.
You'd had the new 25 pounders round about.
That's right, yes.
Did that impinge on you at all? Was the battery pleased to get
them? Oh yes, definitely. We felt as though we got a winner there, that we really got some equipment with which we could do justice.
How do you think it compared with the 18 pounders that you'd had? What was better about it?
Well, the longer range, for one thing. More manoeuvrable, I would think, was the fact that everything was brand new, gun towers, guns, everything else.
Whereas you got fully equipped right through?
Fully equipped right through, yes. Oh, yes. Well, we even got new survey equipment and signal equipment.
New survey equipment you got, was it just new versions of the old stuff, or was there anything new coming
through? No, we then got what they call 360-degree dial sights.
What were they?
Well, in other words, on the theodolite, the original ones were what they call 180 degrees.
This is your director, you mean?
The director, yeah.
So now it was right round.
And that's right, and the dial sights on the guns were 360 degrees as well. So
advantage did that give you? If you could just
In other words, we had to sort of, we used to have right and left, you see, for if we were measuring an angle to anything, and we used to have to do so many degrees right or so many degrees left, whereas in this case, it was a question of, you know, you just went round the clock. 360 degrees. And of course, what you had to do, if you got an angle, you passed a reverse angle, deducted it from 360 degrees for the gun to come back to you, so to speak.
So it made life easier.
Oh yes. We very quickly got used to them.
What happened next then?
We were dictated by what was happening up the desert. I mean, the Italians had been routed. Obviously, Hitler didn't like this, the fact that this flank was being exposed, and decided to send Field Marshal Rommel with his Africa Corps to do something about it. And, of course, that having happened, the next thing we knew was that these people were on the move, and we were sent up the desert. We didn't know quite where, but we at some stage or other, we were going to meet them. People who were up there were forced back, and they were forced into Tobruk, and we got into Tobruk just on as Rommel surrounded it. I know I'm going ahead a little bit here, but the journey into Tobruk overnight was a bit of a nightmare, to say the least.
What do you remember about the whole journey? Because the regimental history makes quite a thing of the journey. And, How do you remember it?
Oh dear, very tedious.
How did you travel as a member of the survey team? What was your travelling?
I travelled in a 1500 weight truck.
Just in the back?
In the back, but took turns at driving. I mean, by this time, we could all do any job, so to speak. I mean, go on the guns and signal and anything. So we took turns at driving. I distinctly remember falling asleep at the wheel, because I was driving at one time. I went to help the Sergeant Major, who got a little bit of fluid on the knee, and he couldn't drive anymore, so I went to drive his truck, and I distinctly remember falling asleep and bumping into the vehicle in front, which didn't do my officer any good, because he finished with a septic elbow.
Well, he scratched it.
That's right, yeah. So much so that when we got into Tobruk, He was out of action for about the first 6 weeks.
That's Birkin.
That was Captain Birkin. And Don Troop, which we were in, was literally, because of the shortage of officers, was run by the Sergeant Major with my help.
I'll come back
for the first
to
6 weeks of the siege of Tobruk.
I noticed something about that, again, in the history. This driving business, what were the stints you were doing to get so tired?
I suppose it wasn't a question of long stints of driving. It was the fact that one hadn't gone to sleep, so to speak, all through the day and the previous day.
What was the convoy discipline? I mean, how was the convoy organised?
Well, it was organised in as much as you had to remain 50 yards behind the vehicle in front. That was not always easy. You had to discipline yourself very considerable to sort of keep watching to see, make sure that you didn't get within that distance. And of course, going over Saloon Pass in the middle of the night was very hazardous.
Why?
Well, the road was very narrow, and nothing to sort of stop vehicles falling off the track. Fortunately, it was moonlight, but that's all.
Did you use lights at all?
No. No, we didn't use any lights at all.
Were there any rules about other traffic on the roads that you had to, that you were told about?
Not to my knowledge. And we weren't involved in, I know one of our guns was detached and sent forward, but I wasn't aware of that at the time, until after we got into Brook. But apparently one of the guns was sent forward in case, to protect the whole convoy, so to speak. In other words, to protect all the soft vehicles at the front.
When you ran into the vehicle, I presume that, you know, when you fell asleep, they'd stopped, had they?
Oh, yes, they'd stopped, yeah.
Was it, how severe was it?
Oh, no, it was. I mean, we were only travelling at about 5 or 7, 10 miles per hour, but, I mean, it was just one of these things.
Would there be no one in the cab with you to try and keep you awake, or had they fallen asleep?
They'd fallen asleep as well, yeah.
So,
that's one blot against my character, you see.
So the last stage of the journey, when you went into Tobruk itself, were you aware of the dangers of what was happening?
No, not particularly. We were obviously keyed up, but I don't think we realised the full sense of the problem. Because, I mean, when one reads what happened now, you know, the fact that we came to within probably a couple of miles of being completely annihilated before we got into the place, and just managed to get inside the perimeter. I think we arrived in about 1 o'clock in the morning.
Were you briefed?
And by about 4 o'clock, I think the whole lot had been surrounded. No, we weren't briefed to any great extent, now.
So this communication,
except we knew there was some sort of urgency, because we got the odd senior officer coming down the column in his truck, sort of urging us on. Come on, you know, don't wait for anything, so to speak.
What were the arrangements for refueling on a journey like that, sir?
Petrol cans.
Each lorry took its own,
yes. So.
What happened when you actually got there, then? You got to Tobruk?
We were, by 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, we'd each been given a gun position. And then, at first light, we realised where we were, so to speak. It was strange, really, because, I mean, in the normal course of events, Charlie Troop would have been on the right of Don Troop, which would, you know, when one normally fell into action on a normal exercise, but this being the real thing, we found ourselves that Don Troop was on the right of Charlie Troop. And there it remained for the whole of the 9 months while we were in there.
Could you describe the position you took up and how you set about taking it? You know, what made you put it there, or were you just told?
No, just told, really. Mm-hmm.
What was the position then?
I can actually give you the coordinates of that position. Any use to you? 413206, that was the Eastings. 425671 were the Northings. And those coordinates have remained in firmly in my mind ever since.
Was that the actual gun?
That was the number one gun of non-troop.
And what were their pits like? What pits did they establish?
Well, they were actually, of course, they were very shallow pits because, I mean, we didn't have an awful lot of chance to dig in the early stages. And let's face it, we didn't realise that we were there for so long. I mean, we thought any moment now we're going to move into something like a more stable position. But this one we adopted and eventually, of course, dug ourselves well in.
So these early ones were just shallow pits. How far back was... You were still with the headquarters?
Well, I was still in the command post, but by then I was in Don Troop.
So you were with Don Troop's command post,
right,
rather than the battery?
The battery command post. So I was just behind the guns about 50 yards at the very most.
And what was the command post? What can you describe it to
just
us?
A trench.
So this wasn't a dugout?
Just a dugout. Not a dugout, just a trench. We dug it ourselves, of course, obviously. And all we got in there was one signaller linked up to the battery headquarters command post, and myself and one officer. Normally,
how soon was it before Birkin went down properly with his septic elbow?
About 2 days.
So very quick.
Very quickly, yeah. So after that, we had to manage as best we could.
What problems did that bring, not having...
It didn't seem to bring any problems at all, quite frankly. Because at the time, we all accepted the responsibility. Obviously, the battery commander kept... The troop commander kept coming down from the observation post to make sure we were all right, but everything seemed to swim along. Then we got the odd officer who came along and to supplement us, but in general, we had to survive without an officer.
In the history, it says that you were involved in setting up the observation post system.
That's right.
Do you remember that? How did you go about that? This was in view of the absence of officers, was it? Or...
Oh, no. No, we had got a troop commander.
Who was that?
Captain Hingston, R.C. Hingston. And he... In the early days, we hadn't got an established command post because all we got was a 1500 weight truck, which found its or a Bren gun carrier, sorry, which found itself engaged in fighting off tanks because we had two or three early tank attacks. Which we were repelled.
That's before you got the observation post system.
Oh, yes.
Oh, well, let's go.
They were in the early days. We went into Tobruk, I believe, on April the 1st, I think it was, which was a very good day to go into anywhere. And within the first week, we'd been hammered by tank attacks to a great extent.
This was your first time you'd been attacked by tanks.
Oh, yeah.
Can you give us some detail of what happened as far as you saw it?
Very difficult. These tanks, there was an escarpment or a ridge, and they came over the ridge, and they must, as far as we were concerned, they were probably about 6,000 yards away. Of course, we were firing at roughly about between 5,000 and 6,000, which rather shook us because we, on exercise, we've been used to firing at 8, 9s and 10s. And literally, I mean, they didn't attack, I wouldn't think, in great strength. Probably came at about 14 or 15 tanks altogether. But
where were you at the time?
I was in the command post, the troop command post.
So this would be a case where you wouldn't be involved at... Survey. I mean, you wouldn't be.
No.
This would be the observation.
No, having got the guns on into position and online and giving them, you know, they would be getting the direct instructions via through the line to the command post and to the wireless in the command post, and I would be responsible for relaying the instructions to the guns. That was my job there.
And what do you remember? So about 15 tanks?
Oh yes, I would be standing probably about 10 or 15 yards behind the guns, having had the instructions relayed to me, and I'd be shouting out to the guns out, you know, all the different angles.
Would you use a megaphone? Or?
Yeah, megaphone we used in those days.
Would they hear that above the noise of the guns firing?
Yes, it was difficult because the firing was almost incessant for quite some time. But we managed to make ourselves heard.
How successful was artillery in hitting tanks like this?
Well, it was rather like going to a cup tie, you know, when you knocked a tank out, everybody cheered. I think on those occasions, we managed to knock out about three or four tanks before they retired. Set them on fire.
Were they a difficult target? What were the problems of aiming at tanks? I mean, was it more difficult than...
Yeah, we weren't firing on open sights, as they call. Open sights meaning you're firing direct at the tank. I mean, you're firing on instructions from... So really, all the officer in the observation post carrier, all he could do was plaster the area and make it difficult for the tanks to continue. And not only our battery, but the first RHA and the 425 battery were all concentrating on this one tank. In fact, we in our troop only got the flank of the attack. The main attack was centred towards the first RHA.
Was this 15 tanks in your area? Or
that's right, yes.
There'd be more further on,
yes.
Is there anything else about that attack you remember, or any of this?
No, we...
You said your command post was used in fighting them off.
Yes. I think in those early days, I mean, I'm talking about the first three or four days in Tobruk, we got a feeling of that we had done very well. In fact, you know, we were sort of rather... Well, I'm trying to get the right word. We were sort of... Our ego was inflated, if you like, by the fact that we'd beat them off, not realising that what was going to happen was that... They weren't going to take this lying down, and the next thing, of course, they'd started with the dive bombers on us. That's the next stage.
How did you use the Bren carrier against... what use is that against tanks?
Well, none at all, quite frankly. But it was literally... We hadn't got any other equipment. So the Bren carrier had to... just take potluck, so to speak, and go... I know one officer actually ordered the guns to fire onto him. In other words, he was so close to the tanks that was in 425 battery.
Yeah. So when you say you used the Bren carrier, what did you use it for?
For passing messages. It wasn't used as a...
It wasn't a Bren that was used,
it was a vehicle. A Bren gun wouldn't touch your tanks at all.
And who did
it? Was an armoured vehicle, that's all.
Who would you be passing messages to that you couldn't do by wireless or telephone?
Well, from the OP. You use it from the OP to the guns. That's all.
Well, the wires
and the OP would also be in touch with the battery commander.
Were the wires cut? Did you?
The problem with the wire cutting was terrific, particularly in the bombing and track vehicles running over the wires. It was almost a 24-hour job to keep the lines. When we were using wires, it was a 24-hour job to keep them intact, quite frankly.
Were they marked at all to try and stop track vehicles?
No, there's nothing you could do about it because they literally sort of... they were just laid at the side of the road, and the track vehicles would go off.
Buried at all?
No.
And not on poles?
No, no time to put those up or anything like that. They would just run at the side of the track.
So you had these initial successes in beating off the tank
attacks. That's right, yeah.
And then you say the dive bombing started.
Oh, yes.
Well, tell me about that.
Yes, that was the first real sort of problem that we met during the war, was the fact that we'd seen these Stukas, as they were called, which Junkers 87s, we'd seen them incessantly bombing the harbour, because obviously the Germans thought by cutting off the supplies they would cause us to surrender, and of course they very nearly achieved that. But having sort of had the tanks knocked out by these gun troops, they decided then that to turn their attention to the guns, and they sent up one or two recce planes, and then the next minute we saw these boys curling around in the air, and there we were. And then when you found out it was your troop that was being attacked, it was not particularly very happy moment. Can I just give you one impression? I might sound a bit silly, but the nearest bomb to me, probably, which killed the chap who was alongside me, probably dropped about 5 or 6 yards away, but it caused so much havoc and blew so much sand up that the whole area was one red mass, if you understand, and the ground literally sort of came up and down. And my first reaction to the whole thing was, well, if this is death, it ain't so bad. I honestly thought that I'd gone. it's a strange feeling, but I never had that feeling ever again. But it was just that I was convinced I'd been hit, and that was it.
From an incident like that, did you get any shell shock, as they call it?
Yes, not shell shock. There's no doubt about it. From then onwards, for many weeks afterwards, the moment you heard a plane, be it your own or one of theirs, you immediately sort of became what you might call, what we described as bomb happy.
What were the symptoms of that? What do you mean?
You'd be hovering. You wouldn't move far without knowing there was a trench available. That's what I'm trying to say.
Did it affect you in your duties at all, do you think? Or was it just...
I think it... Obviously, we lost one or two blokes in that raid. Seeing someone actually killed, and the young lads, it wasn't a pleasant experience, but... we seemed to survive it. By that time we'd reached the tough stage of life where we'd been out in the desert something like a year and a half or something else, and we were prepared for anything, quite frankly.
During the actual air raids, did they use the sirens?
Oh yeah. The air raid sirens for us.
No, I mean on the dive bombers.
Oh yes, that screaming noise when they came down.
Did that affect you?
Yeah, it was a very, very. What shall I say? It was a frightening experience to hear these dive bombers come screaming at you. Yeah.
And do you think the siren noise that they had? Do you think that actually made it worse?
I think it did. I'm sure that was a psychological thing that the Germans had brought in. Because I think they turned the sirens on as they went down, didn't they? Yeah. They had a job of pulling out, you know. One bloke actually, out of the crowd that dive bombed us, he actually hit the ground. But albeit about 50, 60 yards away from the position. But they always, And they were sitting ducks, you know, when they pulled out, because it took them quite a while before they could pick up speed again.
Did you have any anti-aircraft facilities?
No, we had a Hotchkiss gun, which wasn't very, you know.
Who would fire that?
Well, we got one bloke appointed for the Hotchkiss. But anti-aircraft protection was, you can virtually say, was nil, because they were, particularly the Stukas, they were heavy.